from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Sleep is one of the most important things your brain will do all day, for reasons that are becoming clearer to researchers. A new report out of UC Berkeley shows that when you're out like a light, your mind is working overtime, processing thoughts and memories for later use. If you learn something today that your brain does not deem worthy of saving, it'll erase it tonight and you'll forget it tomorrow. This hour, we'll meet a UC Berkeley researcher who's leading this research, and we'll take your questions on how to get the most from your time in dreamland. The Secrets of Sleep. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Here's a phrase I personally need to stop using. Dead asleep. The truth is, when you're asleep, your mind is anything but dead. It's very much alive, processing the information you've been getting all day. That is just one of many discoveries from new research on sleep coming out of UC Berkeley. In this hour of Forum, we'll explore the secrets of sleep, and we'll take your questions on how to make your sleep better. Let's talk to Professor Matthew Walker of UC Berkeley's Sleep and Neuroimaging Laboratory. He led two recent studies on what happens when we sleep. Professor Walker, good morning.
Good morning.
Feel free to get in touch with us this hour with any of your questions or thoughts on the way you sleep. Call us, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also comment on our Facebook page or send us a tweet. We are at KQED Forum. So, Professor Walker, first of all, I am probably going to need all the information you give just as much as everyone else, because my day usually begins at 3:30 in the morning. Just yes, and the engineer, I see him waving his hand, saying amen as well, because we're here at 3, 4, 5 in the morning trying to do what we do. I know we talk to people with a whole spectrum of different sleep needs, but one of the interesting things you just told me before we went on the air is there is still an enormous amount about sleep that no one knows, including some of the fundamental aspects of why and how humans sleep.
That's right. Yeah. So sleep is probably one of the last great remaining scientific mysteries. We still don't yet have a consensus scientific answer as to why we sleep. What we're starting to find is that the answer is probably not for one single reason, but for a whole constellation of different functions that sleep serves important needs for the brain, but also downstairs in the body. And in fact, there's probably not one tissue in the organism that sleep does not affect. So I think what we're finding is that perhaps we've been asking slightly the wrong question, what is the single function of sleep? It's what are the multiple functions of sleep? Of course, the crass answer that's been given before is that we've known the function of sleep for a long time, and that's simply to cure sleepiness.
Right, exactly.
but that doesn't really move you very far along in terms of the scientific knowledge. And it is a strange concept to ask, and if you just frame the question, imagine sort of the birth of your first child, and the doctor walks in and they say, congratulations, we've done all the tests, it's a healthy boy or a girl, and they smile, and they start to walk away, and then they turn around just before they get to the door, they say, but there is just one thing, that from this point forward, for the rest of your child's life, they will go into a state of non-consciousness that will look perhaps not dissimilar to death, but don't worry, it's reversible. In fact, they will spend one third of their life doing this. It will repeatedly happen every day. And doctors and scientists cannot give you a satisfying answer as to why. It sounds utterly remarkable, but yet we're still sort of at that position now in terms of our knowledge of sleep. But we are starting to find a lot of clues.
Sweet dreams. That's definitely not going to help me get to bed tonight. This one third of my life spent in a death-like coma, which now makes even less sense. So that I don't know if I feel better or worse about that. But I think I can feel a little bit better knowing that there's more research coming out as to the nature of how we sleep. There are two studies that you were involved in most recently, one that has to do with how sleep relates to memory. Explain that one first.
Yes, so we've been finding that sleep is important for memory in at least three ways. Firstly, sleep before learning seems to be necessary in preparing your brain, almost like a dry sponge, ready to initially soak up new information and effectively learn and cram in information. But then we also know that sleep is essential after learning for two other reasons. Firstly, sleep after learning can grab a hold of that new information that you've learned and essentially solidify it and cement it into the neural architecture of the brain. And therefore, those memories are not as likely to be forgotten. So it's like hitting the save button. But most recently, we've been discovering that sleep can do much more than simply strengthen individual memories. Sleep can actually intelligently cross-link large sets of information together and start to seek out statistical patterns and understand rules, embedded rules amongst all of that information. And you can come up with creative, novel insights. So it's perhaps no surprise that nobody ever tells you you should stay awake on a problem. Instead, they tell you to...
You should sleep on it.
Sleep on a problem. And in fact, what's interesting is that if you look across languages, that same phrase is there in many languages, at least many that I've tried to inquire about. And what that tells you is that that phenomena of sleep-inspired creativity and problem-solving transcends cultural boundaries. I should note, by the way, that we, the British, we say you sleep on a problem. The French, actually, the translation is you sleep with a problem. And I think that says so much, by the way, about the difference between the British and the French. But I won't
think
go
it
there.
Does. I don't know what the French are doing when they're sleeping with the problem, but that problem could take a lot of forms for the French, I suppose. Now, that sounds like the value of sleep for, say, a student is not just getting a really good night's sleep before a test or before you're going to take on a new chapter, but making sure that the night of that, once you've already gone through that, that you also need to make sure you bed down for a good 8 hours.
That's right, yeah. So we've done an experiment, for example, to test the theory that you can pull the all-nighter and learn effectively. So this is going back to the sleep before learning question. Firstly, what we find is that when you're sleep deprived, there is about a 40% impairment in your brain's capacity to learn new information.
And so you're 40% less effective at learning when you're sleep deprived.
Learning and cramming new facts. And just to put that in context, it's the difference between acing an exam and failing it miserably, if there's any students or educators out there. But you're right that then sleep after learning is essential then to take that information and prevent it from being eroded by the sort of the ravages of time. Sleep seems to protect those memories. And so as you move through the following days, you can recollect that information.
What are some of the cues that tell your brain this is something that I need to remember or that's something that I should just forget?
Yeah, so that's an interesting point. And what we've been finding recently as well with sleep is that it doesn't just take all information that you've learned during the day and then save all of that information. Instead, sleep seems to be attuned to certain red flags that have been associated with those pieces of information during the day. And what I mean by that is things that are salient, things that are, for example, emotional or rewarding or beneficial or negative and aversive and unpleasant. These types of tags actually are placed on those memories at the time of learning by certain types of biology within the brain. And sleep seems to be quite sensitive to them picking up those specific tags. And it will take some things that you've learned and realize they're the most important things and strengthen them. And then other things that perhaps haven't received that tag, sleep will actually not only not strengthen them, but actively help them be forgotten. So sleep actually, whilst overall seems to have a memory benefit, it actually is a bit more nuanced than that, that it can, in a clever way, figure out which things are most important to remember and which things perhaps you've already got stored and you don't need. So let's forget that.
Now, does that mean that when we're dealing with new information, and I keep coming back to the example of a kid in class because that's one we can all relate to. Does that mean that when we're tackling new information that our conscious emotional state plays a factor in that? Is that something that I can, you know, if I can make myself a little bit happier or a little bit jazzed up to go into class, is that going to have an effect on my memory that I can control, that I can manipulate? Or is it more random than that?
No, not random, but more
subconscious than that.
There is a degree of sort of explicit manipulation that you can do. For example, I can tell you that the information that you're learning right now is something that I'm going to subsequently test you on tomorrow, whereas the information that you've just learned, it turns out we're not going to test you on tomorrow. And even that explicit conscious information given to your brain, in fact, even though it's happened after you've learned, is sufficient to change the trajectory of remembering and forgetting of that different information during sleep at night. So it's both, I suspect, explicit and conscious, but there's also implicit non-conscious tags that happen as well.
So for teachers who are listening to this, tell the kids you're testing them on everything. Don't let them get away with anything.
And then just make sure they sleep.
And then just make sure they get 8 hours of sleep, exactly. So that's one study for sleep and memory. The other one, as I understand it, had to do with the way that sleep changes as you age. What did you find with that one?
Yeah, so it's slightly depressing news for many of us who are progressing in our age, me particularly rapidly. What we've been finding is that sleep doesn't remain constant across the lifespan. As many of us know, our sleep can start to get worse as we get older. And also what we've known for a long time in the brain sciences is that as we get older, our memory gets worse. We get forgetful. We can't learn things as effectively. And those two things, poor memory as we get older, poor sleep as we get older, as I said, have been recognized and characterized for some time. What we recently identified and discovered was that those two things weren't simply independent, but instead they were significantly interrelated. And in fact, it's the deep sleep, what we call deep non-rapid eye movement sleep, the deep stages. That type of sleep is the sleep that falls off and gets impaired most dramatically as we get old. It turns out to be the same sleep that is critical for grabbing hold of those new facts from the day and saving them at night. And we found that with older people, as they lost their sleep, the brain was not as effective at night at cementing those new memories, and hence they forgot considerably more the next morning, about 50% more.
Do we have any idea why that happens? Is it just a function of aging, or do we know more physiologically what's going on?
Yes. Yeah, so what we also found in that study was the physiological in part answer, which is that the brain deteriorates as we get older. We also know that. But the brain doesn't deteriorate homogeneously. Some parts of the brain deteriorate more dramatically than others. Unfortunately, the parts that deteriorate most dramatically, which are parts in the middle of your frontal lobe, those are the same areas that are critical for generating that deep slow wave sleep that we call it, that deep non-REM sleep. And so with that brain deterioration comes the deterioration of the ability to create that deep sleep. And if you can't create the deep sleep, you can't save the memories as effectively. So it's this descending chain of command, which unfortunately is not a good thing.
And just to be clear, just so everybody is fully along, when you're talking about deep non-REM sleep, you're talking about non-dreaming sleep where you are just out.
That's right. So we have principally two types of sleep. On the one hand, we have non-rapid eye movement sleep. And non-REM sleep has four separate stages, stages 1 through 4, unimaginatively
logically
called.
Enough, yeah, right.
And then on the other hand, we have rapid eye movement sleep, or REM sleep. And REM sleep is the stage from which we principally dream, whereas non-REM sleep, we tend not to get prominent dreams from. And the deeper stages, stages 3 and 4 of non-REM, that's where the brain seems to go into this very slow pattern of idling electrical activity. And it's that type of deep sleep that seems to be good for cementing new facts that you've learned.
We're discussing the secrets of sleep with UC Berkeley Professor Matthew Walker. We'd like to take your questions and thoughts about the nature of your sleep, if you're getting enough, and if so, how, and if not, we'll see if we can figure out why not. Call us, 866-733-6786, and email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. And I should be clear, I think, that Professor Walker is here in, and I know this should go without saying, but just to be clear, here in a research capacity, not in a diagnostic or a clinical capacity. So I don't think that if you have serious questions, you should talk to us instead of your doctor, perhaps in addition to, but this could be a way to start the conversation. Speaking of which, let's start the conversation with Peter in Berkeley. Peter, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I'm sure many people would like to hear tips of what to do when you get mentally excited, around bedtime or perhaps after, when you know it's time to sleep for the next day. And a related question, what causes that unwanted bounce when you get overtired, and what to do about it?
Thanks, Peter. Professor?
So in terms of the first question, that sort of racing mind notion, I think we as a society have to start to learn to give some decompression time before we get to bed. In this day and age, it turns out that it's usually only when our head hits the pillow at night that, in fact, we finally get some time to think, which is a little bit unfortunate. We tend to be very much on send and receive for the rest of the waking day. If you have that racing mind, one way that you can try and help that is by having a pad of paper and a pen next to your bed and just cathartically write out all of the things that are in your head. Usually people get anxious at that time around bed because they're thinking, oh, I've got this to do tomorrow and I forgot to do this. And that just self-perpetuates this state of hyper-excitement and you won't sleep very well. So trying to cathartically get those things down on paper and get them out of the head is quite useful. In terms of the bounce that happens when you don't get sleep, and I'm not too sure what you mean by that, but certainly what we know is that people can become overly emotional without sleep. We found that the deep centers of the emotional brain can be 60% more reactive without sleep, and it seems to be because part of the controlling frontal lobe of the brain loses its ability to regulate the older, deep emotional centers of the brain, and perhaps we're now starting to understand why we become emotionally dysfunctional without sleep, and also perhaps why so many psychiatric mood disorders have co-occurring sleep abnormalities.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that when you sleep, you kind of strengthen that higher order function part of the brain. And when you don't sleep, that part of the brain, the higher order function, is weaker and it's not strong enough to control just the basal, emotional, instinctual part of your brain.
Exactly, yeah. So it's almost like an emotional gas pedal and brake. And when you've had a good night of sleep, you refresh the balance between those two. But without sleep, you seem to be too much emotional gas pedal and not enough brake.
Let's go to some of the email questions. Joyce from Sebastopol writes, I usually sleep better if I have a couple of glasses of wine during the evening. Does alcohol affect the functions of the brain that should be working during sleep?
Very much so, and it's a great question. Firstly, alcohol can be a sedating drug. It can people will often think that it's useful to help initiate sleep, to send you off to sleep because of that sedating benefit. But there's two problems with alcohol and sleep. Firstly is that alcohol will fragment your night's sleep, so you will wake up more frequently. Second, alcohol turns out to be quite a good suppressor of rapid eye movement sleep, of dream sleep. And so alcohol can block the REM sleep or some of the REM sleep that you are having. It turns out that that phenomenon of having maybe a few too many drinks and then having very intense dreaming the next morning can be explained by this phenomenon. What happens is that when you've had a bit too much to drink, the alcohol is in your system for a lot of the night. And the sleeping brain is smart. It knows how much REM sleep you should have been having during the night and how much you haven't been getting, like a clock counter. And then finally, when your liver and kidneys have been able to excrete most of the alcohol, your brain then goes on not only to have the rest of the REM sleep it would have had, it tries to get back some of the REM sleep that you didn't have. It's called a REM sleep rebound phenomena. And so you have this really intense REM sleep late in the morning. And that's why people explain having these bizarre dreams, because dreaming is where we get, is from principally REM sleep.
So you're going to get the REM sleep one way or another. You can do it the easy way or the hard way, but your brain's going to do it.
Well, the brain will try and get back some of that REM. Unfortunately, it's never able to get back all of it. And so you can't, it's not like the bank that you can't build up a debt and then hope to pay it off. The brain tries to do some of that, but it's unable to do all of it. So it's a bad thing.
Let's take another call. Cy in Fremont. Cy, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about the circadian rhythm. About the second question that you said about the patterns that brain can assimilate during the REM sleep. Is brain capable of doing computations at that stage? The reason is specific to my experience. About two times a month, I see, whenever I get up at night, once or twice, I see the clock to the exact minute that I know that this is the exact minute, and I see the clock is exactly right. So I'm not sure if that is recorded or that is ever experienced by anyone else, but just curious if this is even possible.
All right, thanks for the question. Can your brain compute while it's asleep?
So there's probably two interrelated questions there about the brain computing. Firstly, I think the caller is speaking about the brain computing and tracking time. And the brain does seem to be able to have the capacity to track time somewhat accurately. And that's why people may be seeming as though they can still manage and sort of track time throughout sleep. But that said, there is a strange phenomenon where you can, for example, be waking up almost 1 minute before the alarm clock happens, and you do that repeatedly, and that seems to tell you that the brain does have some ability.
I do that all the time.
Yeah, be understanding time. But the paradox, however, is that you can also then hit the snooze button, go back into REM sleep and start to dream, have a florid experience that feels like it lasts 15, 20 minutes, and then the alarm goes off again, and you realize it's just been 2 minutes. And so there's a strange disparity in terms of time in regarding sleep, particularly dream sleep versus just entire sleep.
We're rapidly running out of time before we hit the bottom of the hour, but please keep the questions and comments coming. I'll read a few more now before we take our first break. Emma from San Jose writes, I've always wondered about the external interferences with sleep. Can you quantify the interference with sleep of things like light, snoring, or the quality of your bed? Will a lifetime of sleeping with a snorer have a measurable effect on quality of life or even lifespan?
So good questions. And some of those we don't know the answers to yet. Certainly auditory stimuli, things like snoring, noise in the bedroom, those things can disturb your sleep. They can either wake you up entirely, or sounds and noises can actually keep you out of those deep stages of non-REM. You may not wake up, but the depth of your sleep is affected by that sound. And so we certainly know that external stimuli can have a marked impact on sleep. And we're now starting to try and understand what that type of ecological disturbance can do in terms of things like learning, memory, and emotional regulation.
Let's go back to the phone with Stan in Sausalito. Stan, good morning.
Morning. How are you, folks?
All is well. What's on your mind?
Well, I recently took up a practice called Qigong, which is translated as energy work. And one of the things that there's a morning and a nighttime routine, and the evening routine kind of gets that energy and out of your body and such in a way that clears your mind and allows you to enter into delta sleep easier. This has had a profound effect over the past 6 weeks. And I've been experimenting with this because I have a brain injury from the past. I actually spent last night sleeping near the ocean. The atmosphere and the amount of light, the natural versus unnatural light, seem to have a huge effect on this as well.
Stan, thanks for sharing that. What do you know about Qigong, Professor Walker?
So living now in the Bay Area for a little while, I've certainly heard of it. But I think more generally, what the gentleman is describing there is just, again, this ability of trying to wind down, doing some kind of practice where you can quiet the mind and maybe just quiet the body too in terms of that process. And those things will help the initiation of sleep, and they will help the subsequent progression of sleep. We certainly know that being emotionally charged throughout the day can have a reciprocal impact on the sleep that you have at night, both how quickly you get to sleep and the different stages of sleep. So I think it again just reinforces this notion that waking experience during the day can have an impact on sleep at night, just like sleep at night can then have an impact on how your waking function is the next day.
Let's try to take a few more questions, maybe one or two more before we break. Anne writes, I am writing because I am a new mom and don't get great sleep. Is there hope that once I get sleep again, I will fully recover from my disrupted sleep? Sometimes I'm wakened 4 or 5 times a night by my infant. I feel very dysfunctional when I don't get enough sleep. Very briefly.
Yes, so certainly, as I said, fragmented sleep throughout the night will cause issues with cognitive function, learning, memory, attention, emotional regulation. So it's a very understandable thing that the caller is going through. And then hopefully once your child starts to get on a more secure sleep pattern, they will too. Try taking naps during the day if you feel as though you don't have enough sleep at night, and at least see if you can get your quota.
We're continuing to discuss the secrets of sleep with Professor Matthew Walker of UC Berkeley's Sleep and Neuroimaging Laboratory. I'm going to step back in the next half hour and try to take as many of your calls and emails and thoughts as we can, so please keep the calls coming. The number is 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also comment on our Facebook page or send us a tweet. We are at KQED Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Please stay tuned. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're discussing the secrets of sleep with UC Berkeley Professor Matthew Walker of the school's Sleep and Neuroimaging Laboratory. Professor Walker, how many hours of sleep a night do you get?
It's a great question. I usually say I will get routinely 8 hours whenever I can, which is never.
Good. But, I feel way better now.
But no, in all seriousness, I probably get consistently about 7.5 hours of sleep a night. If I get less than 7 hours, I can observe the impairments. There is a slight irony to studying sleep research, which is to understand the thing that you're trying to focus on. You have to deprive yourself of the very same thing. that paradox is quite humorful for me.
So you get about 7.5 hours of sleep a night, roughly?
I do, yeah.
How? How do you do that?
Well, firstly, when you understand how important sleep is, both for the brain and the body, trust me, there's a remarkable motivation to start prioritizing sleep in life. And I think that's something that we have to do. It's perhaps not surprising that society is sleeping the way it is, which is insufficiently, for a number of reasons. Firstly, work time durations have increased, commute times have increased, and nobody wants to then go home and spend perhaps less time with their family or less time watching television. So the final thing that gets shortchanged in our 24-hour period is sleep. I think secondly, the reason is that people just believe that when you're asleep, the brain is dormant and the body is at rest, so nothing really much is happening. And in fact, nothing could be further from the truth. The brain is as if not more active than when we're awake. There's a remarkable impact on the body in terms of metabolism, immunity, weight control, regulation aspects. So I think we just haven't done a good job at communicating to the public the importance and the scientific benefit of sleep. And then I think the final thing is that we in society have started to adopt the attitude that sleep is not only simply a luxury that we could choose or choose not to engage in, but getting sufficient sleep is equal to being lazy. And that's a terrible stigma to have in terms of something that is a biological necessity. And that what's interesting about that is we don't always have that stigma. And let me give you an example. Nobody looks at an infant sleeping during the day and says, well, what a lazy baby. And we don't, because for some reason we know that at that time of life, sleep is absolutely essential. But then somewhere between infancy and adulthood, and it actually happens very quickly, we abandon the notion that sleep is important. And in fact, we try to shortchange it, even in schools with continued activities, homework, constant pressures there. So I think it's a dangerous adopted attitude.
And there's this weird, almost like this cultural fetish we have with being up all the time. I mean, from, you know, New York taking pride in being the city that doesn't sleep to, you know, those Under Armour or Nike ads just say, you know, you can sleep when you're dead, you know, work on it now. And it's like we have this weird sense of bravado about never having to sleep. And yet everyone I meet who asks me, gee, you do the morning news. How early do you have to get up in the morning? 3:30. Oh my God. They all know on some level it makes no sense to just defy sunrise like that.
Absolutely.
So we have this weird kind of, you know, split personality when it comes to how we deal with our own well-being.
Right. And I think we all know how good it feels and how well our brain and our bodies operate when we do get sufficient sleep. One of the problems with sleep loss and sleep deprivation is that your subjective assessment of how you're doing without sleep is a miserable predictor of objectively how you actually are doing without sleep. So people say, no, I'm fine on 6 hours. It turns out that's incorrect. It's like the drunk driver saying, no, I'm not impaired. I'm fine to drive. It's incorrect.
Well, I'm going to take a nap so we can take a few more calls. Monique in Millbrae, good morning.
Hi. I have 4 kids under the age of 8, and I feel like I've streamlined my sleep to the effect that my friends who have 1 or 2 kids, they seem to have a lot more problems functioning during the day than I do. I was wondering if when you have more kids, if you become more efficient at your nighttime sleep.
So I actually don't know if there's any research on the relationship between number of children and the ability to sort of deal with that sort of change sleep pattern that happens. Certainly, what we know is that as you get continually more and more sleep deprived, the brain will start to create a greater hunger for that sleep. So when you do get to sleep, you may be having deeper quality sleep as a consequence with all of that work that you have to do. But I don't know of any research that answers that question, to be honest.
Shoshana from Berkeley writes, what are the effects of Ambien on sleep, especially when taken every night, the prescription drug Ambien?
Yes, so Ambien is a newer class of sleep medications. The older class, they were called sedative hypnotics, and those, as the term suggests, sedating medications would put you into something that you're not awake in terms of a brain state, but it was a little difficult actually to describe it as physiological sleep. Those newer medications like Ambien produce perhaps somewhat more naturalistic sleep, but there are several caveats there. One of them is that those types of sleep medications can keep you out of the deep stages of non-REM sleep, stages 3 and 4 that we described, those that are important for brain plasticity and learning and memory. And there's only now been some emerging studies to show that those sleep medications may prevent some of those critical plastic brain changes from happening at night. So we need to do more of that research because there are millions of people taking those drugs.
Faye from San Francisco writes, what about nap? I wish I could do that in the afternoon, but I cannot seem to nap for lunchtime at work. Do naps, say 15 to 30 minutes, help the brain remember and think? Can we make up lost sleep?
So I'll take the first part of the question, and then we'll come on to the making up of sleep afterwards. But certainly we and others have looked at naps. We tend to look at naps that are a little bit longer, 60 or 90 minutes. And those naps do seem to be able to produce observable, measurable benefits in terms of learning, memory, the regulation of your emotional brain. It's actually an interesting question as to whether we should, in industrialized nations, be sleeping as we are, which is what we call monophasically, which means one long bout during the night. If you look at cultures not touched by electricity, some of them will actually sleep biphasically. So they'll have a longer bout at night, maybe 6.5 hours, and then they'll have that siesta-like activity in the afternoon. And it turns out that most of us actually have a dip in our biological level of alertness just after lunch. It's the reason that we all have those ugly head nods right. In meetings after lunch. And it's because we can observe that biological dip, which again argues that physiologically, there is argument that we should be sleeping also in the afternoon too. So we can measure those benefits of naps. Certainly, it's unclear as to whether you can make up sleep that you've lost. I see it all the time in students. I call it sleep bulimia, where they short sleep during the week, then they binge at the weekend thinking that they can make it up. In terms of learning and memory, we found that that's not the case. As I said before, sleep is not like the bank, that you can't accumulate a debt and then pay it off at a later point in time. It's sleep in terms of learning and memory seems to be an all or nothing event.
It's almost like getting too much cholesterol in your body and then saying you're going to eat nothing but vegetables for 2 weeks and expect it all to go away.
Right, exactly. So you have to be getting it routinely. If you don't snooze, you lose in that case.
Let's go to another call. Neil in San Francisco. Neil, good morning.
Yes, I've heard of, or rather read, of causes, that is, links between sleep apnea and mental illness. Do you know anything about that? Could that be true?
So I don't think necessarily there's a vast amount of research regarding the relationship between sleep apnea and mental illness. Certainly what we do know, however, is that there's a remarkable co-occurrence between psychiatric mood disorders and sleep abnormalities. And there is now starting to emerge research that suggests, in fact, they're not simply co-occurring, but they may actually be causally related. And so we're now starting to unpack that. But it's remarkable to see that in almost every psychiatric emotional disorder, sleep problems are present. In fact, they're so hand in hand. The sleep problems form a part of the diagnostic criteria for some of those mental disorders. That's how intimate that relationship is between sleep and emotional health.
Let's take another call. Christina in San Francisco. Christina, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask about talking in your sleep. So I talk in my sleep quite frequently. Most times I don't hear it, but sometimes I talk so loudly that I actually wake myself up in the middle of a sentence. So I was just wondering, what effect does that have on my sleep? Does that mean that I'm not getting a good quality of sleep, or, what's going on when you...
Oh, sorry to cut you short, Christina. If I could tag on to what she said, I knew someone who talked in his sleep and what he would say directly related to his work. It sounded like he was still processing it as if he was awake at work and, you know, firing on all cylinders. How much of an effect does that have, talking in your sleep?
Yes, yeah, so sleepwalking and sleep talking, these actually come not from dream sleep, which you perhaps would imagine. They actually come from non-rapid eye movement sleep. And they're part of something that we call parasomnias. In other words, things that happen around sleep, parasomnia. And so it's not necessarily pathological. Unless it's significantly troubling you, there isn't necessarily a need to go and seek medical treatment, although you can. It seems to be that the brain goes from deep non-REM sleep, the deeper stages 3 and 4, and seems to get ejected out of that and tries to go up to wakefulness as though the brain is going from the basement to the penthouse, but gets stuck somewhere in between. And so you're neither quite awake nor asleep, and you can act out quite sort of basic routine things. People will walk down the stairs, they can open up the refrigerator, they can walk over to the door, lift a glass, these types of basic things. But if you ask people what was going through their minds, they tend never to be reporting dreams.
Let's hear from Trudy in Richmond. Trudy, good morning.
Good morning, doctor, and it's about my son, and he has sleep apnea, and he's probably obese, and he falls asleep downstairs watching television and snores without, and he doesn't have his mask on, and I'm a fearful person. I'm afraid he may die. And I'm always listening for the gasp that brings him back. But I hate to say, because he's almost 50, go upstairs and put your mask on. He's temporarily living with us. What should I do, if anything? And he can't see a doctor due to finances.
Okay, so Trudy, before he answers, I just want to clarify. You said your son does have a CPAP mask, so he
yes.
is able. Okay, so he does have access to that.
But he uses at night.
That he uses at night, but it's not always available when he drifts off
no,
during the day.
No, because the bedrooms are upstairs.
Okay, Trudy,
and
thank you.
If I ever see him in bed without it, I tell him to put it on. And, you know, that feels weird, too, because he's a grown man.
Right. Well, definitely that's something that's affecting more and more people. What about that?
Yeah, so really I can't give you medical advice not being an MD, but I would certainly encourage you to go and continue to try and get some kind of medical input there. I know obviously there's issues of cost, but certainly the importance of sleep I think would still motivate some try and some avenue to try and explore that.
Jack from San Jose writes, I have recently been using a sound machine at night. I find that it helps me get to sleep faster and I feel more rested. Can your guest comment on this?
So there hasn't actually been any systematic research that I know of the impact of those types of sound machines throughout the night. Certainly they can be helpful for some people to initiate sleep. The potential danger is that if the sound is disruptive enough, it will, as I mentioned before, potentially keep you out of those deeper stages of sleep. It may not be sufficient to do that, but we actually haven't got a lot of research that examines those types of sound machines.
Hussam from San Jose writes, what is the average sleep time for men aged 45 to 50? Personally, I can't sleep more than 5 hours a day. Does that make me more vulnerable to Alzheimer's disease in the future?
So we certainly know that there's a range of variability across the population in terms of sleep and sleep need. A good estimate is about 7.5 to 8 hours of sleep. And interestingly, that need for sleep doesn't seem to necessarily change throughout the lifespan. The ability to get that sleep, that's the thing that does seem to change across the lifespan. So the notion of perhaps, you know, only being able to get 5 hours of sleep a night is very different to simply saying I only need 5 hours of sleep a night. The need seems to remain constant throughout the lifespan.
We're continuing our conversation on the secrets of sleep with UC Berkeley Professor Matthew Walker. Got a few minutes left. Feel free to call or email 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. Bridget tweeted us, great discussion. Sleep also influences appetite. I would love to hear more about that.
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. There's now good epidemiological evidence of a link between sleep and obesity. The less sleep that you're getting, the increased risk for obesity. We're also understanding why that's the case. There have been studies where they will short sleep you for a couple of nights and look at, for example, the hormones that control your appetite. There are some hormones that make you want to eat. There are other hormones that don't make you want to eat. They suppress your appetite. And unfortunately, without sufficient sleep, it goes in the way that you wouldn't want. You actually increase the hormones that tell you to eat and you decrease the hormones that tell you not to eat. So it puts you in this quite incendiary situation. And so perhaps no wonder we're finding this link between obesity and insufficient sleep.
Let's take another call from Alex in San Francisco. Alex, good morning.
Hi, how are you? A good segue from the comment about hormones. My question is, melatonin is available now and is a supplement. And I'm wondering if the guest has any perspective on the use of melatonin to both go to sleep and stay asleep.
Yeah, it's a good question. So melatonin is often called the hormone of darkness, and the reason is because it signals to the brain that it's nighttime, and that's how melatonin can help your brain and your body be regulated according to the wake-sleep light-dark cycle. There is some evidence that melatonin may have a benefit in terms of helping regulate your sleep and the time that you go to sleep and also the initiation of sleep. I think there's far less evidence or there's far more discussion as to whether melatonin is at all useful to helping you stay asleep. I think that's probably less clear.
A few more comments from the web. John writes, I'm a programmer. Often I will fall asleep after being stumped on a programming bug. I'll sleep for a few hours and wake in the middle of the night knowing exactly where in the source the bug is and how to fix it. It's an awesome and freaky experience. Laura writes, what about caffeine? I have a high caffeine tolerance, can drink coffee or caffeinated soda all evening, and still have no trouble falling asleep. But what is it actually doing to the sleep and dream process?
Yes, so there is, again, quite an array of sensitivity to caffeine throughout the population, as your caller there said. Some people are sensitive, some people are not. The way that caffeine works is this, that across the day, there is a chemical that builds up in your brain that starts to tell your brain how long you've been awake. And as it builds up more and more during the evening, it starts to make you feel sleepy. That chemical is called adenosine. The way that coffee works is by its active ingredient, caffeine. Caffeine will come in and it will block the adenosine receptors in your brain. And so now your brain thinks, there's not as much of this sleepiness chemical hanging around in my brain. So maybe I'm not as sleepy as I thought I was. The problem, of course, is that that chemical adenosine continues to build up even while you're drinking the coffee. When the coffee is now out of your system, then you get this crash because that swath of that chemical comes right back in, and that's how you get the caffeine crash.
Let's take another call. Noah in San Francisco. Noah, good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. I was kind of interested in the anthropological and evolutionary history of sleep because I can't imagine that cavemen got really good sleep, you know, with all the things they had to worry about. So has sleep kind of evolved over time, the way we need to sleep? And, you know, do you think they actually got 8 hours of sleep back at the caveman days, or was it something completely different?
So it's a good question. And of course, we don't really have any of the measurements or the metrics to answer that question. Certainly, the point is a good one, which is you would think that sleep is the very worst thing that the brain could have evolved to do, because you're non-conscious. It's for humans when we sleep, it's nighttime. You're vulnerable to prey. You're not finding food. You're not finding a mate. You're not socially interacting. And so it seems like a bad idea. The fact that sleep has persisted throughout evolution, and in fact, we've observed sleep in every species that we've studied to date, despite what seems to be a bad idea, it tells us that sleep, therefore, must be important at the most basic of biological levels. And so I think that the notion there is that simply reinforces how essential sleep is, and perhaps how unwise we as human beings are, because we are one of the few species that will deliberately deprive ourselves of sleep.
What about people who have to sleep at odd hours? Myself included. I mean, I have to be here at 5 a.m. to do the news at 6, so my bedtime is usually around 7:30 or 8. For people who work odd shifts, midday shifts, where they can't really rise with the sun and set with the sunset, what should they do? What seems to work?
So you should always try to get the sufficient 7 to 8 hours of sleep that you need. One of the problems with sleeping at non-optimal times during your biological rhythm, which is what you will be doing then, is that the architecture of your sleep will be a little different. It turns out that early in the night, your brain seems to want more deep non-REM sleep. And as you push through into the later morning hours, your brain seems to hunger and want more rapid eye movement sleep. And so if you're placing that 8-hour window of sleep time at different windows during the 24-hour period, it can potentially change the architecture of the sleep that you will have. And therefore, you may not be getting optimally perhaps what your brain needs.
So your brain is kind of wired to want what it wants.
Exactly, yeah.
So I'm stuck.
I will pause and pass on that question.
Thanks a lot.
You're
welcome.
Kathy
writes on our website, can you have too much sleep, assuming you're in good health?
That's an interesting question. There is a concept called hypersomnia, where people seem to be sleeping excessively long amounts. It's unclear whether, in fact, that research suggests that people are just sleeping too long, or they're just staying in bed too long and sleeping yet still a normal 8 hours. There is a strange phenomena that doesn't have much research behind it, which is the sleep hangover effect, which is where people will say, my optimal sweet spot is 7.5 hours of sleep, let's say. But then at the weekend, my alarm didn't go off and I ended up sleeping for 10 hours. And for the rest of that day, I just felt miserable, which sounds contrary to what we're speaking about here, which is the benefit of sleep. And so it may be that just like there's a bad thing about being awake for too long, there may be a bad thing about staying asleep too long. So getting the optimal 16 hours of wakefulness, 8 hours of sleep, may be the best balance.
Paula from Healdsburg writes, before I had a child, I could sleep through a fire, so to speak. Ever since, and it has been 20 years, I sleep ever so lightly most nights and often need to wear an iPad, earplugs, and take a sleeping aid to get a good night's sleep. What changed in my brain?
Yeah, so it's hard to know what changed there. Certainly, it could be independent of having children. That's simply the progression with age changes sleep, as we've already spoken about, that the quality and the depth of your sleep deteriorates with age. So it's unclear whether it's independent of having children. Children certainly change, as we've already spoken about, too, our sleep cycles. We start to wake up earlier with them. So several of those factors could contribute to that.
Pam writes, I have always been a sound sleeper, yet have rarely ever remembered dreams. I remember having dreamed maybe once a year. I've always had a good memory and continue as a writer of back-of-the-book college textbooks into my 70s. Does the research deal with this at all?
Yes, so it's not entirely unusual to have that description that you don't remember your dreams. Of course, it doesn't mean that you aren't dreaming. We tend to forget most of our dreams, and we're not really sure why we do that. But certainly if we bring people like that into the laboratory who say, I never really dream or I never remember my dreams, we can then wake them up as they're in dream sleep, and then repeatedly, consistently, reliably, they will be reporting dreams. So it's not a case of them not having dream sleep. It's just a case of them not remembering the dreams that they were in fact having.
And is there any kind of biological value to remembering your dreams, or is it just one of those things?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And some people try to adopt something called lucid dreaming, where they can actually become aware of their dreams and control their dreams. So it seems to be unclear as to whether there is functional utility to remembering your dreams or not. That the system seems to have principally programmed the brain to not remember dreams, consciously at least. That doesn't mean that they're not stored non-consciously, but consciously suggests perhaps it's not that important for us to be remembering our dreams.
Megan writes, what are your thoughts on sleep apps like the Jawbone Up Band that monitors your deep and light sleep and gives feedback?
Yes, so it's unclear right now the validity of those apps as to how faithful they are in terms of measuring the sleep that we would be able to measure in the sleep laboratory. So that's one question. The second question, is it a good practice? Certainly, I think it's fine to become more aware of the sleep that you're having and try to get more of it. The only danger is that you then become the Woody Allen neurotic of the sleep world, which is that every night you're looking at your app thinking, okay, last night I got 96% efficiency. Tonight I have to beat that. I want to get 98%. Or my partner, they got 98. I need to get 100. That's when things become problematic.
Can get a little maniacal after yeah. a while. Too much information can be a bad thing.
Yeah.
Lila writes, my 7-year-old son has struggled with insomnia his whole life, always waking up too early and often even for long stretches in the middle of the night. Are there any treatments for children such as him or any studies you know of that he might partake in?
So there is a wonderful sleep medicine center at Stanford. And if you are local in the Bay Area and you have concerns about your child's sleep, that would certainly be a great resource to connect with.
Let's take another call from Wendy in San Jose. Wendy, good morning.
Good morning. So a week or 2 weeks before my period comes, I would have problem waking up really early and cannot go back to sleep. Is that normal and what can I do about that?
So, yeah, but certainly we know that hormones, which obviously regulate those types of menstrual cycles, change the regulation of sleep. So it's perhaps not unusual. Again, I would simply advise you that if you are having problems with your sleep, you can speak to your primary sleep, your primary doctor, and see if you can get sleep help.
Since we're talking about resources, I know our hour is almost up. For people who have more questions and won't have time to get them answered here, what would you suggest are some really good, solid resources for good information about the nature of sleep, ways to improve your sleep, ways to study what's going on? What would you recommend?
Yes, so there is a wonderful resource. It's called the National Sleep Foundation, and if you just go online and Google National Sleep Foundation, you'll get to their website. It's got lots of tips for better sleep. It's got lots of information about sleep disorders, and it's also got information about specific sleep clinics nationally. So that would be a wonderful thing to connect with.
Stephanie from Marin County writes something that I have dealt with, and it's absolutely terrifying. I'm glad she wrote this question in. Stephanie writes, I sometimes experience sleep paralysis when my mind wakes up, but I cannot move my body. And I have to try to scream in order to make someone hear just some mumbling for me. This is terrifying when it happens, even though I know it's not a permanent state. Can you explain this phenomenon? I have had this happen to me before, and it is horrifying.
Yeah, I can explain it, and I too have experienced it. It's not uncommon. About 25% of the population will experience it. It's, in other words, it's about as common as hiccups. What happens when you go into REM sleep is that your brain paralyzes your body so you don't act out your dreams. It's a very clever system. The only problem is that occasionally what happens as you wake up in the morning is that your brain wakes up, but the paralysis remains. And so you are pseudo awake, but your brain is paralyzed and you hence can't move. You can't shout out. You can't sometimes even open your eyes. It's often associated with the feeling of an intruder being in the room. It's quite uncomfortable. It turns out to explain almost all so-called alien abductions, by the way.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, if you think about the scenario, very few people explain alien abductions during the day when everyone else is around. It's usually at sleep, during sleep at night, when you're alone in your bedroom. It's a description of people coming in. There's a presence in the room that you can't move. You can't shout. They paralyzed you. They injected you. So, no, the sleep paralysis, we can understand. It's simply a remnant of that paralysis that is normally present during REM that doesn't release the body when you actually wake up.
One last question before we're out of time. What about the nature of what you're sleeping on? The quality of your bed, a Tempur-Pedic, a waterbed, a plain old box spring, does it make a difference?
It certainly can make a difference. So uncomfort and pain that can come through and discomfort, they can all affect the quality of the sleep that you have. If you feel as though you're not getting that robust quality of sleep because of that physical sensation, doing something about it would be very wise.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground in this hour. I'm exhausted. I need a nap.
Me too.
I'm burned out. Thank you. Thank you, Professor Matthew Walker from the University of California at Berkeley. Fascinating research about the nature of how we sleep. I wish you a good night's sleep from now on and to all of our listeners. And thank you for talking to us.
You're very welcome. Sleep well.
Forum is produced by Susan Britton and Irene Noguchi. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our online producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News. Thank you very much for listening. I think it's time for me to, you know. Dave Iverson is with you tomorrow. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.